Well, in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Studies Memory Initiative presenting Learning, Memory, and Cognitive Development. They're all in your connections. By Jay McClelland, Carnegie Mellon University, on Monday, November 8th at 4 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming composer Philip Glass with the Bang on a Can All-Stars, Naumburg Competition winner Frank Wong for a violin recital, and Ivo Pogorelich for a piano recital. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Well, good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be looking at some issues involving low-level nuclear waste. Now, when people talk about nuclear waste, as I said before the news, I think most of the time the conversation has focused on high-level nuclear waste. This is the material, spent fuel, that comes from nuclear power plants that generate electricity. The federal government now has been engaged in a long effort to set up a site to store high-level waste. A place has developed. It's in Nevada, although continues to be very controversial. People in Nevada don't want it, and there are still some scientists who raise questions about whether or not that is a good site. But there is also other kinds of waste that is not as radioactive, however, is still hazardous, and it also has to be stored appropriately. Back in 1980, the Congress said to the states, "You states need to figure out how you're going to deal with this," and suggested that they could get together and form regional compacts, and then among those compacts decide on some place in one of those states to develop their own site to store that waste. This was in 1980. And to date, I'm a little uncertain. I think actually my guest informed me here that I was a little bit wrong. I thought there were no new sites. I think maybe there might be one, but the fact of the matter is that the states really haven't done what Congress had asked them to do back in 1980, despite spending a very significant amount of money. It's estimated that something like $100 million has been spent by states in the effort to develop these new sites. We also did that here in the state of Illinois. Although it's been out of the news for some time now, you may recall that there was an effort to set up a site in Clark County in a place called Martinsville. And then a little bit more recently, although we're talking now about several years ago, there also was another site selected in McLean County. The state some years back put the whole effort on hold, but this whole thing has not gone away, certainly. And we're going to try to catch up on all of this this morning in this part of Focus 580. Our guest for the program is Clark Bullard. He is Professor Emeritus of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. I will not read you his entire vita. However, I do want to mention that in addition to teaching and working in mechanical and industrial engineering, he spent a time as the director of the Office of Energy Research and has been a faculty affiliate in the Nuclear Engineering Department. He also, for a number of years, served on the Central Midwest Low-Level Radioactive Waste Commission as commissioner and also as chair. And as we talk this morning, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call with questions. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure being here.
We appreciate it. To begin, maybe one of the most basic sorts of things that people ought to know is low-level waste. What is it?
Well, most of it, too, comes from nuclear power plants, about 90% of that generated in Illinois. It is everything from booties and gloves to the kind of radioactive sludge that accumulates on the inside of plumbing pipes in a nuclear power plant. That sludge inside the pipes can become radioactive and then has to be removed and disposed of. So there are irradiated parts, pieces of metal, all kinds of waste, things that you want to put, that you want to get rid of that is no longer economically useful. Now, the other waste comes from medical establishments, university research labs, industries in Illinois, like, formerly Allied, now Honeywell in southern Illinois, engaged in part of the process of producing nuclear fuel. And another site up in Morris, Illinois, an old General Electric facility that's involved in a lot of high-level waste transportation storage, and they generate low-level waste as well.
So that's a little bit on what it is and where it comes from. Maybe then next I might ask you, and I gave a very, very quick gloss, and I hope that that was – I didn't skate over the facts too seriously. But to go back and talk about what it was that the Congress said to the states back in 1980 about setting up their own facilities to store this material.
Yes. In 1980, the Congress gave the states the authority to keep other people's waste out of their state. They gave them a mechanism called an interstate compact. We have interstate compacts dealing with management of rivers that divide state lines and these sorts of things. They're just a contract, an agreement between states, where the states sign this agreement and it's ratified by their state legislatures and by Congress. And basically it's a way, in this instance, in radioactive waste, it's a way to get around the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Because what happened back in the 1950s when we started, President Eisenhower started the Atoms for Peace program, all of the radioactive waste disposal sites in the country, about a dozen of them, were military sites, and some of it was dumped at sea. But by about 1960, it was clear that the civilian industry was coming on stream, and ocean dumping was no longer allowed. So six commercial facilities were built around the nation, including one in Sheffield, Illinois, and another in Maxey Flats, Kentucky. So all six of those facilities then started having problems in the 60s. Several were shut down, like the one in Sheffield as it started leaking. The one in Maxey Flats, Kentucky was shut down because it started leaking. Then in the 70s, at one point, a truck showed up burning, caught on fire at one of the other facilities in Nevada. And that was closed temporarily. And this was, I believe, right around the time of Three Mile Island in the late 70s. And then there was a lot of discussion about where all that Three Mile Island waste was going to go. And the governor of South Carolina actually resorted to calling out the National Guard to try to stop trucks at the state line that were headed for the Barnwell, South Carolina disposal site, because that state legislature had passed a law saying that they were not going to accept anything over a certain amount of waste each year. Mm-hmm. So that was created a constitutional crisis where the where a state wanted to impede interstate commerce. It was unconstitutional. They could not do it. So Congress gave the states the authority to go into these interstate compacts. Illinois was about to join the Midwest Compact of about 8 or 10 states. But since we were the largest generator, because we had the most nuclear power plants, it became obvious that we were the ones who were going to get the site. So before the Illinois legislature ratified it, they amended it to say no shallow land burial, which is the technology used at all these sites earlier that had problems. And the other states wouldn't buy that. That left Illinois alone. So we decided to do it our way. We formed a compact with Kentucky that has no nuclear power plants, just a few medical and academic and industrial facilities. They produce very little waste. We agreed at the outset that Illinois would be the host state, but Illinois' Department of Nuclear Safety would be able to define the rules as to what kind of monitored, retrievable storage and disposal facility would be built, so we could have tougher standards that way. Mm-hmm. So that's how we got there. And all of the other compact regions did too. And there were deadlines and surcharges all the way through the late 1980s. And the deadlines slipped, and the states, like Illinois, tried to site facilities for a variety of reasons. They failed. Illinois spent $80 million alone on the Martinsville site characterization and facility development. And then what happened in the late 1990s, the Supreme Court declared part of that 1980 law unconstitutional. There was a provision in there that the utilities wanted, the utilities who generate most of the waste. They wanted to make radioactive waste a government problem. It used to be a commercial site problem regulated by the feds in the 1960s and 70s. That failed. They wanted to hand the problem over to the states. So there was a provision in there that if the states did not develop their own disposal facilities in each compact region, then the states would have to take title to all of the waste. And that was judged unconstitutional in the late 90s. So now the teeth are gone mm-hmm. out of that system. And now we're in more like a market-oriented system. Barnwell, South Carolina site is still accepting waste from outside its compact region. And a new site was developed in the desert of Utah west of Salt Lake City. The Utah site has permission from the Northwest Compact to accept very low-level waste, high-volume, low-level Class A waste from outside the compact region. And it has about 20 years left of storage capability. The Barnwell site, however, has a legislative deadline. The South Carolina legislature says we're going to phase it out starting now and not accept any out-of-region waste by 2008. So now that puts states like Illinois and really the utility industry and the other generators of radioactive waste, that puts them mm-hmm. puts the responsibility back on them.
To wrap that up, right now, if you ask what's happening to the stuff, some continues to go to Barnwell, although it's coming to the end of its life.
That's right.
There's a site in Utah that accepts the lowest level of the low-level waste. And I think also that, and now this may not be true today, but I think that I read that some was going to Hanford in Washington State.
That's only waste that is generated within the Northwest Compact states.
Okay.
There's
just
11
the
states in the Northwest. Yes.
How is that? And I think also that some of the generators, and I guess the only ones who really would be in a position to do this, would be the nuclear power plants, are storing on site some low level waste, just as they are storing on site their high level waste.
Some generators, the University of Illinois is a terrific example, who deal with only radioisotopes that are very short lived. They are storing on site, and if you store it for 10 half-lives, 6, 10 years, 20 years, the radioactive activity decays to background levels. Hmm. So some of the lowest level waste is being handled that way by on-site storage in hospitals and places like that. However, it's not the price of disposal at these two sites that are open has been increasing steadily, and I don't think anyone wants to get caught with a lot of waste when Barnwell closes or if there's some kind of an accident or shutdown at the Utah site.
Yeah. Well, let me reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Clark Bullard. He is emeritus professor in mechanical and industrial engineering at the University of Illinois. And among the things, served on the Central Midwest Low-Level Radioactive Waste Commission. He was commissioner for a number of years. This was in the mid from, well, 1984 until 1998, and also spent a time as a chair. It's an issue that he has been involved with in the past, and he came in this morning and admitted he'd kind of been out of it for a while, so he really had to spend a lot of time brushing up, and I appreciate his putting in the effort and being here this morning so that we could talk about it. Dealing with low-level nuclear waste, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So just before we get back to, I want then to again take a few steps back and talk a little bit about what happened here in the state of Illinois. But just recently, I came across a story where some members of Congress were apparently talking about the fact that they felt that now, seeing the way things have gone and the fact that states have not developed their own sites as the intention was, that perhaps the federal government is going to have to think about setting up a federal site to take low-level waste as they are setting up this federal site to take the high-level waste because the states haven't done it. Do you think that that's the way that things are going to go?
No, I don't believe so. I believe that the General Accounting Office, which serves both the House of Representatives and the Senate, came out with a report last summer where they laid out the state of the situation. There is another site under construction in Texas. And may turn out to be accepting waste from outside of that compact. Mm-hmm. So it's a wait-and-see proposition right now. The physical size of the storage facilities available or disposal facilities at Barnwell are limited, and they're only taking the highest level of the low-level waste, the most radioactive part. Mm-hmm. But from a place like Illinois, that's just a couple of roomfuls per year. So even if Barnwell closes for good or shuts out of region generators, they've threatened to in the past, and the state has always wanted to make a little more money. And
they've just jacked up the price.
Because it's not a state site, but there are surcharges that go to the South Carolina state budget. And you know, the price of disposal has gone from a couple of dollars a cubic foot up to $600 a cubic foot. So it's not, you know, it's on the books, but it's been on the books before in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So there is this wait-and-see approach. And since the volumes of the waste going to South Carolina are so small anyway, it would be possible for many utilities and hospitals, if not all, to just store on site for a while, or for Illinois to develop a temporary storage facility. But the 90% of our waste volume goes to EnviroCare in Utah, and that's the situation with most other states. So they say they have 20 years left. So there's really not a lot of urgency right now. What you may be hearing about in Congress is serious concern over what's called greater than class C waste. There's high-level waste, which is the spent fuel, and that's what the Nevada Yucca Mountain site is all about. There's low-level waste, which is class A, B, and C, depending on how radioactive it is. But then there's something called greater than class C waste, which is too radioactive for low-level waste. And there are basically the states are not responsible for it, and the federal government has no facility, but the Department of Energy has recently been directed to develop one really fast because that's the type of material that could end up in a dirty bomb. And since 9/11, it's mostly sealed sources that are at construction facilities, medical facilities, the type in instruments that are used to determine soil moisture at construction sites, for example. There's a quarter to a half a million of those around, and the federal government has had a high priority on trying to find them. They're not as well regulated as other types of waste, or not as well tracked. They've recovered about 10,000 out of the quarter to a half million that are no longer wanted. Some of those are being stored at Los Alamos on an emergency basis because there's no federal long-term disposal facility. And others, the people who have them now are being asked to keep them until a disposal facility is available. Mm-hmm. So the Congress is dealing with issues related to that.
We have a caller here, so why don't we bring them into the conversation, and then in just a moment here, what I'll do is ask Professor Bullard to give us, again, sort of the thumbnail sketch of the effort to find a site for storage here in the state of Illinois. Caller here is in Combine. Calling from a Combine. I was thinking Combine was a place. Line number one, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Interesting show. Yes, sir. You might have answered this question. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. What form is the waste in? Is it solid or liquid? And I'm a bit rusty. I didn't have a handle on this at one time in my life, but is it possible to re-fertilize that spent fuel in, say, a breeder reactor and make it viable again? Thank you for your time, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Well, those are really two different sorts of questions. Maybe we did talk a little bit about this at the beginning, but again, for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in late, when we talk about this low-level waste, what is it? What's the nature of the material that we're talking about?
Most of it is solid. Can be paper, cloth, mops, pieces of metal. Sludge out of the inside of pipes. Sometimes that sludge is mixed with chelating agents, which try to dissolve the sludge, and that makes it difficult to handle at a burial site because it likes to head for water.
Mm-hmm.
So there's chemical stabilization that goes on after that in many cases. And some of it is liquid mixed with oil and can be burned at even places like Abbott Power Plant. So that's what low-level waste form is. High-level waste is spent fuel rods from nuclear reactors, and I think what the gentleman was referring to is something called reprocessing. Those fuel rods can be reprocessed into plutonium, which can either be used for bombs or it can be used for breeder reactors like they do in France to fuel other reactors and to make power out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole reprocessing issue and its weapons implications and security implications is really part of the high-level waste debate, not the low-level.
Yeah. So if the caller wouldn't mind if we leave that, that's kind of another show. We thought we'd really want to concentrate here on the low-level waste issue. And again, other people have questions. You are certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, to get back here to talk a little bit about what's happened in Illinois, and again, sort of to review, as you explained, what happened was essentially in 1980, Congress said to the states, you states are going to have to get together and figure out what you're going to do with this stuff, and suggested that what the states could do was form associations of neighboring states. And so 10, I believe there are 10 compacts that formed different regions. The states sort of got together and said, okay, well, we'll deal with our stuff. And in Illinois, because we had more nuclear power plants than anybody else, as you explained, if we had gone together with any states around, in Illinois, we had to know we were going to end up being the storage site. There was some controversy about the nature of the site. So the state of Illinois said, fine, we'll just go and we'll form our own compact. We form a compact with Kentucky because Kentucky doesn't generate very much waste. So it wouldn't be importing much. Mostly it would be what we've got here. So there was a long and very expensive first pass on this. And they ended up with a site in Clark County, place called Martinsville. And then after, again, a long process of hearings that we covered here, my colleague Celeste Quinn spent an awful lot of time covering this story and then covered the meetings. There was a commission put together. They looked at all of the information about the site and ultimately, after all of that, decided that the Martinsville site was unsuitable. So there, and at that point, then they kind of had to start all again. Maybe just you want to talk just a little bit about that, about the first pass through.
Yes, it started with good intentions. The state, the Compact Commission, designated Illinois, gave them the responsibility for developing the facility. The state wanted to try a voluntary process, where it did characterized some sites all over the state, the geology and other factors. And then 17 counties were responding with requests for more information. What do we do to take the next step? Because the idea was to negotiate at the end as to what benefits and what risks the counties would assume. And some counties started asking how much are the benefits. And one, in a moment of weakness, I think our state director of nuclear safety said you could levy surcharges up to $1 million a year. And within a week, I think we had, instead of 17 counties, we had two. And they thought that that was not enough to compensate them for the risks that they perceived. So when it was down to two, there were referenda in those counties. Wayne County rejected it. Clark County by a 56, no, Martinsville had an advisory referendum that was 56% in favor. Clark County at large was 26% in favor, but the site was within a mile and a half of Martinsville, so they proceeded. And then there were many news stories and allegations of, in fact, one state agency, the Geologic Survey here, had some of its reports edited and altered by the Department of Nuclear Safety consultants, and they objected to that publicly, and the director of nuclear safety was forced to resign, and a three-person siting commission was set up, chaired by a Supreme Court justice, a University of Illinois civil engineering professor, and a Carolyn Raffensperger, who was the head of the Illinois chapter of the Sierra Club. And that three-person commission heard testimony for almost a year and finally decided that the site was unsuitable. Mm-hmm. But our compact commission was really on the outside of that hearing because we were finished, theoretically, once we handed the problem over to Illinois and designated Illinois. But we decided that in order to make these hearings fair, and even before any hearings, we wanted to give counties enough money to hire their own independent consultants. So we gave some very large grants during those hearings, almost $750,000, to the League of Women Voters, who then accepted proposals from pro and anti groups in Martinsville. And any group who felt their views were unrepresented or underrepresented and didn't have the money to hire attorneys. I mean, these were like Chamber of Commerce type groups who wanted to argue that this would be an economic development opportunity for the town, but they didn't have the money to hire expert witnesses and lawyers. So it went to both sides. And after the hearing, the Supreme Court justice, after almost a year of hearings, he said if we hadn't funded those intervener groups to put contrary evidence on the table, those hearings probably would have been over in a week.
Hmm. And the bottom line was the site was not suitable because there were concerns about the site leaking radioactive material into the groundwater.
And possible routes over the surface before it was detected could get to surface water supplies in the Martinsville area.
So then just real – I have a couple of callers here I want to get to. But real quick, just to go on to the next spot, and as I understand it, what happened after the first round when the idea was to make this process voluntary, that is to let communities look at the pros and cons, and then if some of them decided that it would be there to their advantage to host the site, and of course that the site was suitable geologically and in every other respect, then you could go along and consider that site. Next time around, the thinking was, well, maybe what should happen is we should have the surveys look at the whole state, do the characterization, end up with a number of places that they considered suitable, and that then Three of those would be selected, and ultimately it would be up to the company that was going to build and operate the site to choose the site. Is that correct?
I believe that's what's on paper now, but it's almost moot. I mean, this was late 90s
right.
Plan. More recently, I think within the last year or maybe two, the State Department of Nuclear Safety had to produce a report for the legislature as to where we were. And basically, they looked at the 20 years of capacity at EnviroCare, another site possibly coming on in Texas, and all of this. We're saying that we have time. We can just wait. And after that new Illinois process was started in the mid-90s was when the Supreme Court declared the take title provision unconstitutional. So really, it's less of a problem for the state right now and more of a problem for the generators of the waste,
mm-hmm.
which some people think that's where the problem should lie, not on the public. Public could be focused primarily on safety regulation of a private disposal enterprise, something we failed to do in the 60s.
Well, when I went out looking for material to try to bone up on the subject as well, I discovered that there was really very in the public realm, there was really not very much available. And the last specific story that I could find mentioning what was going on here in Illinois, I think was from 2000, which at that time the state was saying essentially what you have just said. Given the fact that it's been very difficult to find the appropriate site, and also given the fact, according to the people speaking for the state, that they sort of said, well, there's really not that much. And there are other places that we can take it. So for the moment, we just don't think it's all that important for us to keep, you know, banging our head against the proverbial wall. And they said, well, for the moment, we'll just put this process on hold. It's not like it's been closed down. It's just we don't need to do this right now. Sometime in the future, we will. But for now, we can go on and worry about other things. I guess my question ultimately is, how long can you maintain a position like that that says, well, we really don't need to worry about this today. Sometime in the future we will, but not now. You know, so it's sometime in the future can catch up with you pretty quick.
I think it can, but that's the bureaucratically optimal solution. And that's and it really is a message to the utilities and other generators to have some contingency plans for on-site storage if the Barnwell option is closed off. And at that point, the state might just reopen a siting process for a temporary storage facility, I mean by temporary 10, 20 years,
mm-hmm.
to see how things shake out, just so the waste doesn't pile up at hospitals and power plants and universities. And a lot of power plants are not located in a place where long-term storage would be appropriate because they're all located near water for cooling. So I think we are in a reasonable position of waiting. But I believe one virtue, one benefit of our American system of government is that one Congress cannot bind the next. So frankly, I think when the need arises again, whether it's in the next couple of years because Barnwell closes or something else happens, we'll start with a clean slate. We have this flexibility in the United States to do that. We might go back to the mid-90s plan that's on the books that lays out a detailed process for how the contractor is going to recommend a site to the Department of Nuclear Safety, and then director of the department will say this one, yes or no. But we don't really know how that's going to unfold.
All right. Well, we have several callers. They've been very patient. Let me again just very quickly introduce our guest, Clark Bullard. He is Professor Emeritus of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering at University of Illinois. And we're talking about low-level nuclear waste, and questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. To the phones here, and Urbana is next, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
About 20 years ago or so, I had a summer job with the Water Resource Division at the Geological Survey here, and one of my jobs was to go with people up there to collect water at both Sheffield and Argonne Labs. I helped a fellow with a auger, and we'd collect water samples. And I do remember from that, the guys there at the lab would test them, and they'd find traces of deuterium and tritium. And I remember especially at Argonne, seemed like they were detecting things just miles away from the source. And so I'm kind of wondering, is that still the methodology that's used to detect how a low-level storage site is containing itself? And also, what is the understanding of how these sites can be contained, if they can be?
The old shallow land burial sites like Sheffield do present a really tough problem because the water, once it migrates off the site and keeps on going, there are huge quantities of soil underground that are contaminated. And a judgment has to be made as to whether you go in and start digging or whether you just let the material move on and hope that it decays to safe levels before it reaches any drinking water supply, either on the surface or underground water. That's basically the approach that has been taken at Sheffield, as far as I understand it. There was a settlement with the company who was responsible, who developed and operated the site, called U.S. Ecology. There was a settlement with them back, I believe, in the late 80s. So there was some money changed hands, and it became the state's problem.
Well, are any of these sites containing their radioactive matter, or do they all leak?
The sites that have been closed, the shallow land burial sites that were closed, like West Valley, New York, Sheffield, Maxey Flats, Kentucky. And even Barnwell, I think, has had leaks in the past, and all of the leaks are dealt with in the way that I described. They try to catch it, and if it's not headed for a water supply and it looks like it's going to decay before it gets there, they can just let it go. Now, the new sites, like the one at Martinsville that was designed but never built, we insisted at the beginning that the waste be put in containers, and then the containers be put in bunkers above ground with ability to identify leaks and ability to retrieve the waste when a leak is found. That's the most new disposal sites under development in the United States, except the ones in Texas and Utah. Are of that type. The ones in Texas and Utah are being sited in areas that are high and dry, and therefore with much less concrete and containers around them. Still more than the old days when 55-gallon drums were just rolled off a truck into a trench. But there's still better containerization today. But in some of these desert sites, the health authorities have decided that it's not necessary to go to the extent that we were ready to go to in Martinsville.
Okay, thank you.
All right, to go to Urbana, this will be line number two. Hello.
Clark, we really appreciate your years of service for the public, both at the university and in government. And I see this low-level waste disposal as a subset of a much bigger waste problem in the United States. We're using resources at a phenomenal rate, and that leads to radioactive contamination, CO2 generation, as in global warming, boron contamination of our rivers, like happened over at the power plant, Illinois power plant on the Middle Fork of the Vermilion. You could truly say we're an affluent society. Why has the government really sort of abandon the notion of conservation as the going back to the source and trying to reduce the problems of waste disposal all the way up the line. Low level, again, radioactive waste being just a subset of a much bigger problem in our nation of disposing of trash and all sorts of toxics. You want to address that?
I guess the approach that theoretically both Republican and Democratic administrations profess to advocate is that if we regulate waste disposal, whether it's radioactive or municipal garbage, if we regulate those disposal facilities and make sure they're safe, make sure they're built so that they won't leak, and that something can be done if a leak is spotted and they're monitored for many years. In the case of low-level radioactive waste, it can be hazardous for 300 to 500 years. So what happens is that the Martinsville facility and Barnwell today is charging $600 a cubic foot for disposal. Well, not surprisingly, we're only getting about 20% of the cubic feet that we used to get when it was a few dollars a cubic foot. So that produced a lot of conservation all the way back up the line. People are using, in research labs here at the university, we're using non-radioactive tracers where we used to use radioactive tracers. Hospitals and other facilities are being much more careful with their radioactive material, and power plants are, so that they don't contaminate something that is not initially radioactive by mixing it with radioactive contaminated material. So the idea is that if waste disposal gets clean enough and is properly regulated, the price will go up and less waste will be generated, more things will be recycled, reused, and the idea of trying to put limits, environmental limits, on waste and pollution is intended to send price signals back to the people who are generating it. And that's the whole approach being taken in Kyoto. You mentioned the carbon dioxide global warming. The global treaty there is to place caps on each nation's CO2 emissions. And once those caps are there, the price of energy will go up and people will start buying more efficient vehicles, et cetera.
But the problem here clearly is that the U.S. is one of the few countries in the world that didn't ratify the Kyoto Agreement and apparently is hell-bent on continuing to use, you know, resources in general, petroleum being one of them, at thoughtless levels, certainly leaving future generations in the lurch. And
well, that's true. With any environmental regulation, whether it's global like the one you're talking about or whether it's radioactive waste like we're talking about here, some states and regions can decide they want to take more risks than others. Mm-hmm. And if Utah and Texas decide that shallow land burial, albeit with better containers than 55-gallon drums and wooden boxes, is an acceptable risk for them and their other generations that follow them, there's not a whole lot that the federal government has been willing to do to set in any they kind of view that as a local state responsibility. Obviously, if it posed a threat across state lines, it would be a different issue.
Sure. Well, we certainly appreciate your years of efforts and keep up the good work.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to someone in Indiana on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Unfortunately, the phone rang when you were talking and you were saying something. I want to make sure I get it clear so I have the facts correct. Did you say that utilities in some way got it so that they weren't responsible for their waste and that the government was? And if that's what you said, I was wondering how in the world they pulled that one off.
Well, they must have hired good lobbyists. This was the case back in 1980 when the Low-Level Waste Policy Act was passed. It gave the states the authority to keep out-of-state waste, out-of-region waste, out of their region, to handle their own. And if the states did not meet a certain deadline for doing that, the states would have to take title to the waste. The utilities wanted that provision in the law. They got it. It was declared unconstitutional in the late 90s, so it is no longer there. The same sort of thing was done with high-level waste. The high-level waste, maybe for more for security reasons, national security reasons, and because it's hazardous for tens of thousands of years instead of hundreds of years, that is a federal responsibility, and the utilities are being charged, taxed, surcharges on waste generation, but it is the federal government's responsibility to build a disposal facility. They've been trying for 25 years to build one in Nevada, or 20 years, and they still haven't done it, and the utilities are being forced to store the waste on site, which is potentially another security problem in these days of terrorism. So the burden has been removed from the utilities, but now in low-level waste, since the take title provision is unconstitutional, it really is back on the utilities. The utilities are going to be the ones who have the problem if Barnwell closes or if the Utah site closes for any reason, temporarily or long term. And they're going to have to do something like on-site storage, and they will, I'm sure, come to the states and say, take our waste, build us a centralized storage facility. It's in the public health interest to do so, and we'll be back in the same sort of debate.
Yeah. Well, given the fact that we know at some point Barnwell is going to close, and so that's not – and even now that's a limited option. In the Northwest, some of the states in the Northwest Compact are sending some of their stuff to Hanford, which is sounds pretty much like a nightmare all the way around for people who are there in that area. We have the site in Utah that's accepting the lowest level of the low-level waste, and we're talking about building a site. There apparently is a site that's going to be built in Texas, like the one in Utah. But so given the fact, and even as you say, because the cost of disposing of this has gotten so high that the generators are doing everything they can apparently to generate less. But we still have a problem. We still have some stuff that's got to be disposed of. Eventually, the Utah site may well fill up, and there just aren't a whole lot of options. I mean, are we going to eventually see some of these compacts actually setting up new sites? Are they going to have to do that?
It's my feeling that if the situation stays like it is and the utilities have the problem, then there will be companies stepping forward to develop new sites. Maybe it'll be a spinoff from the old Commonwealth Edison, now Exelon Nuclear. And they will offer to build a site in a state, and they will try to get regulatory approval, and the state will try to set up standards that are safe enough. And the price may be a lot more than $600 a cubic foot. But I think that's the way things are going to unfold. The real pressure for this will be when the current generation of reactors are decommissioned. The newest reactor today out there was ordered in 1974. Mm-hmm. So these are all going to be coming to the end of their life in the next, by about 2030 at the latest. So these are going to involve huge quantities of low-level waste. The utilities would like to be able to just, they call it entombment, pour concrete inside the reactor facility and let it sit there and cool off for decades or century. Because they're close to water, there's concerns about that. So there's another option called safe store. Let's monitor it and let it sit and cool off for a while. Let's move the most radioactive components off to disposal. Those issues are all on the table, but my guess is that after this experience with government-run command and control authoritarian siting processes, I think we're ready to try a more market-oriented approach, but this time with government really having regulatory teeth and communities able to cut their own deal in terms of long-term care funds that are set aside and all sorts of things like this.
This is a very complicated story. It has lots of facets. Unfortunately, we're kind of at the point we have to finish. I just want to ask real quick, before we got going here, you talked about the fact that because of the security concerns arising out of 9/11, just for you, for someone like you who was just interested in researching and getting up on the topic again, it was difficult to get a hold of the information. In future, how difficult will it be for citizens to have an informed role in this process?
If we were trying to go through a siting process today in Illinois, it would be very difficult for citizens, I believe, to get this information. When I was chairman of the Radioactive Waste Commission, the transcripts of all of our public meetings were on the web. Now they're not. They were taken down after 9/11. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for the second time since 9/11, has taken down their entire public docket site for review for potentially sensitive material. They did that once before, right after 9/11. They did it again about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So, for example, in preparing for this program, I couldn't find anything on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission site. So if we go into another public process like this, government will have to pay a lot more attention to placing information where people can get at it, because the nuclear industry has still not earned back the trust that was lost in the 1970s with these disposal failures in Three Mile Island. They have to earn it back, and without information in the public domain, it's going to be extremely difficult.
Well, thanks very much for being here. We appreciate it. Clark Bullard is our guest. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. The program today is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted, oriental, and Persian rugs of every size and color combination from new to antique to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Focus 580 is also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, for a time in the 19th century, she was one of the most famous women in the world. She was a woman of the Victorian age, a woman of the British upper middle class who traveled to Crimea at the height of the war to nurse the war's casualties. Biographer Gillian Gill will be talking today with Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine about her recent book, Nightingales, The Extraordinary Upbringing and Curious Life of Miss Florence Nightingale. That's as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with news and weather and sports and other things, and the interview comes in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. We're going to take a break, as we usually do, for news, 1 minute past the hour, and before that, an update on the commodity market, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with an update on the market. Like commercial buying, as well as oversold technicals, are supporting the soybean